I would like to welcome you all back, and especially Your Holiness, to this third day of the 30th Dialogue of the Mind and Life Institute. We've been talking about perception, concepts, and today we talk about the self. We've heard a lot about the Buddhist approaches both to perception and to concepts, and also about scientific approaches. And what we're going to try to do today is tie the notions of perception and concepts into the notions of self. And in order to do that, what we will begin with is some philosophical analyses of self to help us understand what we mean by self. We'll begin in the morning with that philosophical presentation, both from Buddhism and from Western philosophy. And then we will move on in the afternoon to a presentation from the standpoint of human development. This evening, we will also then have a dialogue on self and self-concepts that starts at 7 p.m. between some younger monastics and some younger scientists. So we have a whole day of self, or maybe it'll be a whole day of no self. I don't know. We'll see. a bad Buddhist joke. I apologize. I'd like to begin by introducing someone who needs no introduction to you, Your Holiness, and that's Professor Geshe Ishi Thubke. Professor Thubke became a monk when he was 13 years old, and he studied at Drepung Losaling Monastery in Tibet itself, where he received his highest monastic degree, the Geshe Tharampa degree. He eventually came into exile and eventually became a professor first in Leh, Ladakh, but then he moved to the Central University of Tibetan Studies in Sarnath, Varanasi, where he became a professor of Mula Shastra, of the primary texts of the tradition. And it's actually where I also met him there in Sarnath, Varanasi, when I was doing my own doctoral research. And I'm happy to say that I received instruction from him on various topics. Professor Thubke will be followed by Jay Garfield, who will talk about the self from the standpoint not just of Buddhist philosophy, but also from the standpoint of Western philosophy. And as it turns out, Jay Garfield also was at Sarnath Varanasi and also studied with Geshe Ishi Thubke. So Jay and I have the pleasure of hearing our own teacher today speak about self from the standpoint of Buddhist perspective. So, Geshe-la, if you will, I'd like to point out to the audience that you will be able to, that Geshe-la will present his talk in Tibetan, and you can listen to his talk through the translation on the radio transmitter. So, Geshe-la, to Geshe-la.
I'm sure the Korean thing is good. That's under the name Inji Yuriya. The any concession. Geshe-la is saying that he is seeking permission from His Holiness, admitting that it is very embarrassing to be speaking on such topic in presence of His Holiness.
Awaken in himself the spirit of that young scholar and student at the debating courtyard, who may be deferential at the beginning, but once the debate begins, wraps his, shawl around and then scream and shout. And so, regardless of whoever is around. So that's the spirit we need.
Even historically. One occasion, the serious debate is planned with some very sort of famous non-Buddhist scholar who come to, who send a message, I will come to Nalanda to debate with Buddhist master. So at that time, the Nalanda's sort of masters, they a little bit hesitate whether we can debate that famous non-Buddhist scholar. So they sent a message to Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna already in South India. So then Nagarjuna said, Oh, not necessary. I go. Instead of me, my
student
Aryadeva, you can go. You can defeat that. Then before that, the Nagarjuna tried to test his student Aryadeva. Then his student, as a student, very much devoted. But at the time for debate start, then he burst, and you see a lot of sort of argument with his own teacher. So before our session, you see Kishila, like other sort of Hasoda, Tibetan Buddhist monk, you see very much respect me. But when they
start debate,
my own sort of experience, the 1958, 59, my final examination. Before they stand, very
differential.
Very much. Once they stand, then I think generally they really debate, really fond to bring some fear in the other person.
Once you push up good to shoot chicken, they should have won it. She did any pet, Lubo Chazan, yeah, get with Totone, and the Yam Chimbuton, so what's in English? Gishitabula has begun his presentation by showering words of praise to His Holiness, also to the Ganden throne holder, who happens to be not in presence right now. And all the scholars from the Buddhist and Western circle. My greetings to you all. Good morning to all. The theme of my presentation is on the notion of self. I'm a little worried that whatever I have prepared might not be conveyed, might not be put across because of the fear and the sense of embarrassment I face in the presence of His Holiness. How I plan to go about with this topic is first to bring in the notion of self that was present before the Buddha came, and then after Buddha came, how there came a twist in the notion of self, and within that, in the Tibetan Buddhist community, we have a kind of a systematic structured way of looking at this notion of self across the schools of tenets, wherein we ultimately consider the views of the Madhyamaka, the middle view school, to be the Prasangika Madhyamika, the consequentialist Madhyamika, middle way philosopher, philosophy to be the ultimate. So in the presentation there is not so much of an element of originality as such. Rather, this effort is a way of collecting, gathering the ideas from all from across the tenets, and then in the in between, then I'll try to chime in some personal thoughts. So when we begin to talk about the self, it is quite natural that we should begin from oneself, looking within oneself, see where the notion of self, how it arises, in what way it has effects on ourselves. We begin with our notion of self, and from that then we move on to our possessions, and then to our immediate circles of families, friends, and whatnot. And then as we go about our life, then we begin to see that we live in an interdependent life, in that many of our conditions are dependent on others. And thus, that kind of a reflection then generates some sense of concern, some sense of concern. I mean, in the early time, because of this interdependence being so intermediate, so immediate, we tend to have easier way to appreciate it. But right now, because of the specialization, it seems like we have moved further away from this appreciation. We have difficulty seeing this fact of dependence. So along with what we might call the development and specialization, we begin to lose that appreciation of our immediate interdependence, and that seem to then limit our sense of belonging to a particular circle, but not to the wider circle. So that way, this seems to then enhance the sense of belonging to a small circle around oneself, and then that of not belonging to another, or the rest of the humanity. And based on that, then it seems to induce a sense of attachment towards the close ones that we associate ourselves with as being belonging to to them. Distance, aversion towards the others. So that's how, over the period of time, we have seen how along with the development trend that we have experienced, how that trend of development further strengthen this sense of belonging to one and that of distance with others, and thus the sense of aversion and attachment. And so it seems like many of our miseries and sufferings seems to come from this sense of attachment and aversion towards others. But at the same time, this sense of self is not to be completely blamed for everything bad. It is also a reason for generating good qualities within us. There is even a reference in the scriptures where it says that the sense of self, the notion of self, is the very support for our achievement of enlightenment. That's the very basis for achievement of enlightenment. What I'm pointing to is that this sense of I, this notion of I, is not only to blame for many of the miseries and sufferings, whatnot, but at the same time, that is also the bedrock for many of the achievements that we aspire for, that we enjoy, including the attainment of full enlightenment. So then, coming down to the notion of self, there happen to be varying notions of self already exists in existence before the advent of Buddha, and there too we see a variety of notions, multiplicity, multiple notions of self. Some amounting to considering self to be permanent, thus permanent to the extent of leading to an eternalistic viewpoint, whereas in other cases the notion tends to look at self as being not just impermanent but also being totally non-existent, leading to a nihilistic perspective. However, in the teachings of the Buddha, the way to move about in cultivating such a notion is that one should not take sides right away without making any investigation, but on the basis of saying, this is what my teacher has said, this is what my Lord has said, etc. So instead of taking sides along those lines, the text in the scripture, Buddha admonishes, advises his disciples, saying, one has to go about practicing the four reliances in that one has to rely more on the teaching than on the person. And within the teaching, one has to rely more on the meaning rather than the words. So that kind of sets the tone for our search for any topic, including the notion of self. Unless and until we go about our search in this spirit, then it would suffice just to have a list of what we have to agree and what we do not, what we do not have to agree. We could just have a list or a textbook which lists all the points of agreements and points of disagreement. So, however, in reality, that's not the way to go about for making in personal development. That's the reason why Buddha advised his disciples to investigate thoroughly before accepting even the words that Buddha taught. And that's one of the reasons for such advice, is because when Buddha himself taught, also he taught in accordance with the disposition, in accordance with the faculty of the person spoken to, irrespective of what would be the reality. So that's the reason why there's this need of differentiating his teachings between definitive ones and the interpretive ones. And another reason for this is that it is only by undertaking this search by oneself that one could hope for a spiritual development. Merely relying on what people said and having a blind faith in them would not bring about such a development. So that's the reason why the teaching about how to pursue studies in this threefold mode, that of learning, that of studying, learning, reflecting, and meditating. That's a clear indication that such a search to be effective to bring about spiritual development should be pursued with such a critical outlook. So, with this introduction now, let me dwell on the positions of pre-Buddhistic philosophical schools. Although there are several subdivisions within them, broadly spoken, we can divide them into these two classes. One alluding to self being permanent, in that it continues its existence across lives, whereas another group would allude to the self being non-existent at all, except for the immediate objects of the aggregates and whatnot. There is no separate self. So through these views, they allude to the self being unitary, partless, unitary, permanent, and independent, whereas other one kind of falls into the other extreme of completely annihilating it. So, in response to this, Buddha has taught when he was approached by his disciples saying this is the way other schools present the notion of self, how do we go about this? Buddha says that that's not the case. The self is a product of many causes and conditions coming together, many aspects coming together, and to that he gives the example of the sound being produced from clapping hands. It is not coming from either of the hands, nor is it coming from something completely outside of it, but rather it is coming in mere dependence upon many aspects coming together. Likewise, it is not that such a self is permanent, nor is this the case that there is no such self, no self at all, but rather that it is a product of many factors coming together. In this regard, Geshe-la pointed to Jay Garfield saying that it is not the case that there is no self per se, but one has to make the distinction between the conventional self and the ultimate self, and that it's the ultimate self that is being denied, not the conventional one. So within self, there is an aspect of it that is existent, whereas the other that doesn't. In depends of their positions, the non-Buddhists, particularly those accepting a permanent self, would come up with this example that just as when some house is on fire, the house would be on fire, but not necessarily the person who owns it. Likewise, when the body disintegrates, the self doesn't necessarily have to disintegrate, and the self instead is completely different from the aggregates in terms of entities, and thus it is permanent, it is unitary, independent. So that's how they would defend their position. In response to that, Buddhist teachings, particularly the sutras in the Buddha, attacks this position by saying that along with accepting the self being permanent as well as pervasive, then that would entail so many fallacies in that if every self were to be permanent, then how would it be tenable for a person to be undergoing change over different stages? We speak the scriptures sometimes speak of 10 stages that a person undergoes in one life, if one were to live a full life. So beginning from the very conception to the initial stages of human development. The person undergoes those stages of development, and thus we can speak in terms of the person being different from one stage to the other. So if self were to be permanent, then this would be impossible. There wouldn't be a case. The body may undergo change, but the person may not be considered to be undergoing change. Whereas this is untenable. Likewise, if the self were to be pervasive, unitarily pervasive to every other instance of self, then we would have difficulty separating a father from a mother, and that of brothers from sisters, but not because they would have the same unitary self pervading them, and in such case then we cannot make such a distinction. Likewise, if a self were to be unitary, permanent, and independent, then when one person is undergoing suffering, everyone would have to undergo same experience, and likewise, vice versa. And whereas the non-Buddhists who ascribe to this this idea of a self being totally different from the aggregates and having characteristics completely opposite to the aggregates, in that the aggregates are impermanent, this self is permanent, and the aggregates have parts, the self is unitary, the aggregates are dependent, the self is independent, and likewise. When they say so, they posit this. They support their position by such example, saying the vacuity in different cups. Although in that particular situation, they may seem to have distinct individuality, but once the pot is broken, then they kind of mingle to each other. They become part of the whole without the possibility of ever being, without there ever being possibility of separating them. That's how they would support it. Now, in the case of the other broad category within non-Buddhists, where their position about self is more pointing to a nihilistic perspective, is that they say they do not account for a person, a separate person as such. Rather, they say that nor is there a continuum of personhood that kind of goes through the different stages of the body. Rather, all there is the mind. All there is the mind and the body. And if at all we were to point to the person, that would have to be the person not different from the mind and the aggregates, and that it starts with the conception, and that it ceases with the death, and that there is no such thing as continuum beyond death and beyond birth, but even within one's lifetime, there is no such thing as a continuum of person. It is just a temporary being associated with the contemporary mind and aggregate collection. Whereas the Buddhist understanding is that although on a grosser level it is the same case, that the mind and aggregates do start with the conception and that it ceases after death. But at a subtler level, the mere luminous nature of the mind, which has no color, no shape, physical property, yet capable of being able to subjectively experience objects and whatnot. So somehow, when the grosser level of the body and mind does cease with the dead, but the subtle aspect of it in the form of pure luminous clarity aspect continues. In a way, we can resort to this example of electricity, where electricity does depend on the wire, but the electricity produced is not the same. So is the case with our body and mind, the relationship between them, in that so long as we have an embodied, gross embodied being, the body and the mind are dependent. And that level of grossness, be that at the mental and the physical level, does start with the birth and ceases with the death. But that doesn't mean that the continuum of body and the continuum of body and mind ceases completely. Rather, the very subtle aspect of it, subtle nature of it, continues. But again, here it is very important to understand that this is very different. This position is very different from the position of the non-Buddhists. ascribing to a permanent selfhood, where they say that the person, kind of an inherent person, continues across lives. So that's not the case. The Buddhist understanding of a continuum, continuity is not the same. Not the same as this. But rather, we are talking of continuity without any need of an intrinsic base, intrinsic base of what do you call unified being. In that, just as for a reflection to appear in a glass, we can have a reflection in the glass without the face kind of having to move into the glass. So mere aggregation of causes and conditions can account for the possibility of continuity. So it is, when we say continuity, we are not saying that the same person continues. It is not the same person as such. But at the same time, it is not a completely different continuum of being. So the Buddhist stand on selfhood begins from this assumption that there cannot be a selfhood totally different from the body, from the aggregates, enjoying completely different characteristics, opposite characteristics to the aggregates. But rather that the self has to be located or posited within the aggregates themselves, not to say that they are same as the aggregates, neither the collection likewise, but yet at the same time it is not completely different from that. So it is it is posited in dependence upon the aggregates. Based on this kind of a position presented in the sutras, then within Buddhism, several different schools developed. Within their purview of locating self within the aggregates, then different positions developed. Some tenets hold that it is that the self is, of course, to be located within the aggregates, but in terms of what is self, how to locate the self, how to identify self, they say that it's the totality of the aggregates, and the entire five aggregates are the self. But then this position is attacked by higher tenets of Buddhists in that if all the five aggregates were to be the person, then every person would have to have five personhoods. Critiques. Then some other tenet schools within Buddhism hold that the person is to be located within the aggregates, yet at the same time it is neither permanent nor impermanent. So that's the position particularly held by Vastiputra school within the Vaibhasika tenet. So this position is attacked by other schools within Buddhism, saying how could there be such an uncertainty about the particular thing in terms of whether it is permanent or impermanent. Things would have to be either permanent or impermanent. There cannot be in between So based on that, they attacked this position, and thus this gives rise to another school having even slightly clearer position about the self in terms of whether it is permanent or impermanent, in that it would be accepted as impermanent. Now, in terms of how this particular position of uncertainty about the self is attacked, there is a very fine line followed in the scripture. They have made this position clear that every people has the right to hold any position they want to. But my very purpose of critiquing your position is not critiquing your right to hold any position that you want to hold, but I am critiquing it for the benefit of arriving at a clearer position myself in terms of what a person is, permanent or impermanent, rather than get stuck in a situation like yours. But in terms of the right for you to hold any position, I have nothing to say against that. So that's so this kind of clarification is something that we come across in the course of seeing this back and forth critiquing of these positions within this larger position that the self has to be located somehow within the aggregates as per the signature position of the Buddhists, which is a departure from the non-Buddhist non-Buddhist schools holding that the self has necessarily to be different from the aggregates, and that they enjoy completely different characteristics. So that's how the lower tenet holders within Buddhism, based on the Buddha's pointing out that self is posited, is to be posited within the aggregates, and move on from different nuances of position within that purview. So they begin with saying all the aggregates, all the five aggregates are the self, which is attacked, and then saying it's not all the aggregates, but it is uncertain as to whether it's permanent or not, yet at the same time dependent on the aggregates. But then we move on to the Jitamatra position, where they posit the eighth category of consciousness called the all foundational consciousness. And this is particularly the case with the sutra school, or the sutra strict orthodox Chittamatrins, who in their attempt to posit self within the purview of aggregate, say that it is the eighth consciousness by the name of all foundational consciousness, which is the self, and that such a self is perennial, that it continues across lives, and for that they give this metaphor. In that the ocean on the surface may be very very disturbed. Yet, irrespective of that, there is always an undisturbed, stable basis at the very bottom. Likewise is the case that the person may on the surface look very unstable and ever changing, going through changes and whatnot. But because of a very stable base underneath in the form of the eighth consciousness, and that is the self. And to this, the Madhyamikas attack, saying that this position is not so different from the non-Buddhist, except for saying that this foundational consciousness is impermanent. It is other than that, it is very similar to. Very similar to positing that the position of the one particular school within non-Buddhist who say that propose a creator, the notion of creator in the form of Shiva, who is considered to be permanent in nature. So the attack to this position of the Jetamatrins from the Madhyamikas is that, except for your position that this eighth foundation is impermanent, it is the rest of the position is very similar to the position of the Shiva proponents in that the eighth foundational consciousness is considered to be the source of all the experiences of the person. The consciousness is the person at the same time that is the very very source for all of the experiences that the person undergoes. In that the mind-only proponents say that there is no external world, everything is mere mental projection, and there too it is the projection of this eighth consciousness. So this position is attacked, and this is how with every critiquing of the lower position within the modern within the purview of the Buddhist hold, we then move on to a more and more refined position and eventually arrive at the Madhyamika, the middle way school proponents. Within that, there is a distinction that the lower Sautantrika Madhyamika, the substantialist Madhyamika, they posit that the sixth consciousness is the person. So although the position is slightly refined in terms of what constitutes the person, what is the identity of the person, yet at the same time there still leaves some room for inherent existence, at least when viewed by the highest school within the Madhyamika, that of the Prasangika Madhyamika, that of the consequentialist, who say that it would be untenable to posit any kind of, even the slightest tinge of inherent existence. In that, if there were to be an inherent existence, then it would any functionality operationality would not be possible. So based on that kind of critiquing, the consequentialists say that everything, including self, is mere designation. Mere designation in that there is not an iota of any intrinsic inherent existence. And that's the reason why Geshe-la was giving this example of computer. And there's the computer, not to say that there is no computer, not to say that there is no self or whatnot, but that the computer has to be posited, has to be established on the basis of this understanding that everything, including computer and self, is a mere designation in dependence upon the basis of imputation. It is neither neither the basis of the individual basis of imputation of the self, nor is it the collection of it, nor is it nor is it the shape, etc. So that's how. But then at the same time, it is not to be posited outside of it, but rather it has to be posited in dependence upon the basis of aggregates. So this position is elaborated through this system of what we call the 7-point analysis or the 5-point analysis, like the 5-point analysis developed by Nagarjuna, where he says that the person is neither, it is not outside of the aggregates to begin with, and then within the aggregates, it is not the aggregates, individual aggregates, not the collection, nor it is the case that the person possesses the aggregates like someone would possess belongings, etc. So anyhow, any slightest indication of the self being independent or self being as an isolated identity from the aggregates, that would amount for inherent existence. That would amount for existing in and of itself, and that is not possible. So the person does exist, but exists conventionally, mere conventionally, but with not an iota of any intrinsicality. That's the reason why in one of the sutras, the Buddha is said to say that he doesn't have anything against the convention, against what the worldly conventions are. That he accepts all the conventions that the world accepts. All he is critiquing is the notion that that the conventionality alludes to things having an intrinsic and inherent existence. So to give an example to this this contention that Buddha accepts all the conventionality, his position doesn't amount to denying the convention, yet at the same time understanding that conventionality, with a difference in that the conventionality accounts for the operationality of things, yet at the same time that doesn't require any kind of intrinsic identity. As an example for this, there is a story in the sutra where there are two people who goes into a temple and they see a mural and they disagree as to who that person is. And when they ask someone, one was pointed to be right and the other wrong. Whereas in actuality, the mural is a mere picture of the being that they agree, that they disagree as to who that is. So the answerer could have said, this is neither that person nor this person, it's just a mural of it. But instead, the person says that it is this person, not that person. So that's what is like saying that we can go, or we can go about with the conventionality, and then that's how things will function. But at the same time, this is not to be collated with the notion that there is an intrinsic identity or intrinsic selfhood. So with these positions, it becomes clear that that in the Buddhist position, it is not the case that self is denied, but rather it makes a distinction between a selfhood that is to be denied and a selfhood that is to be upheld. since there are aggregates that are the basis of appropriation by the person, then there has to be an appropriator. But at the same time, the appropriator doesn't need to be completely distinct or completely isolatable from the appropriated objects. So on the basis of that, it makes its case that the person and the aggregates are intertwined, and that the person, the notion of person, can be posited correctly only through this means of seeing it to be designated upon the basis of aggregates, rather than seeing it to be something to be independently findable within the aggregates or outside of the aggregates. Yet at the same time, the problem with us is that when we see things which are merely conventional existence, we have this illusion of things having an intrinsic identity, intrinsic to the point that they almost seem to do what they do on their own, by their own power, on their own, in and of itself, whereas that is not the case. Everything that happens only by being contingent on many factors contributing to it, just as when we grow crops, the crops grow independent upon so many causes and conditions. But then, if we were to casually look at it, it would almost seem like it is doing so by its own power, that too from its own side, and that's the illusion that we get with regard to self also. And that is what is being attacked. But this is not to be misunderstood to mean that the self per se is being denied, is being attacked. In the scriptures, in the classical scriptures, it often employs the example or the metaphor of chariot for making this case of how self exists conventionally, yet at the same time it does lack any intrinsicality or inherent nature of its own. Just as a chariot, though it is existing there conventionally, that is operational, that we can point to and make use of whatnot, but if one were to search for it by going even slightly beyond the line of conventionality, then we would be at sea of finding it. Yet at the same time, that is not to convey that there is no chariot. The chariot is there, obviously functional, operational, yet at the same time, that is not to be collated with this wrong perception, with this wrong notion that there is an intrinsic chariot. So likewise, based on that, we use this metaphor to apply to the notion of self, in that the self is a designated independence upon the independence upon the basis of its aggregate, basis of imputation or designation in the form of the aggregates. Yet at the same time, it is not identical to. It cannot be identified to the basis of aggregates individually, nor the collection, whatnot. So. In regard to this, the sutra clearly makes this idea clear by using yet another metaphor, in that the person has as its basis of designation or as its basis of existence various elements or various principles, that of fire, water, etc., space, and that of sun, and that of mind. Yet at the same time, it is neither any one of them individually nor mere collection. Yet at the same time, it is not completely outside of it. It is merely dependent or contingent on them. So based on that, one makes the Buddhists at the very highest level of understanding posits conventional self that is contingent on its aggregates like that. So based on this, the Buddhists have been associated with the notion of non-self, but very often people mistake this to say that Buddhists deny selfhood per se. It is not the case. Buddhists accept and uphold selfhood, but the selfhood is impermanent, not unitary but with parts, and is not independent but dependent on its basis of aggregates. So when we say Buddhists accept selflessness, or they deny self, one has to understand this to be a denial of a permanent, unitary, independent self, a self that would be that would be existing inherently. So such a notion of self is denied, and based on that, Buddhists came to be associated with the notion of selflessness. But to extend that to say that the Buddhists deny self per se is a mistake. Likewise, when we say that there is self, there is an impermanent self that kind of continues, that has to be understood in its own perspective, in that because it is impermanent, it is undergoing momentarily change. So there's not an iota, not a simple instance of self that maintains its, that retains its identity without change at all, even for 2 moments. At every stage, it is totally changing. Yet at the same time, such a continuity can be posited. And based on that continuity, with an account for how what one does prior in the previous moment can have an effect on the person following it. So that's how we account for the law of karma, etc. Based on this understanding of self, which is merely contingent, yet at the same time capable of being continuous.
It's quite an amazing talk. You covered an amazing amount of ground in such clarity. As His Holiness said just before you began your talk, you're certainly one of the top scholars of Buddhist philosophy in this generation alive. So we thank you very much for that, Tujiche. And now we're going to move on to Jay Garfield's presentation. But I want to offer His Holiness a moment. If you have any comments you'd like to make at this point, I hope we will have some time for discussion after Jay as well. But if you'd like to make any comment now. That is awesome. I need super key.
In general, the sense of I, the notion of I, is something that we find in all sentient beings. But in the case of humans, because of our intelligence, we tend to then investigate into it. So that's a special quality of the humans. Based on that, the human sense of inquiry goes into areas such as climate, etc., and thus even explores into how things might have originated, then such positions of pointing to a creator principle may have come about. And more so, such is possible when humans, despite the intelligence of investigating things, found themselves in a place of incapability, in a place of incapability, when in the midst of the overwhelming environment around, when they found themselves helpless in certain cases, and that's how it would naturally lead us to believing in a higher power that may hold the string to everything around. Likewise, although we wouldn't at all think that this person with this aged body was there at the time of birth, nor would we think that this mind that has undergone such change was there at the time of at the time of conception. But at the same time, when it comes to the notion of I, that seems to be something that we happen to have across time, and that we seem to be comfortable in accepting that I existed all throughout, and thus such kind of acceptance then points to the possibility that maybe such a self is totally different from the aggregates, in that it might not undergo changes like the aggregates do, and thus it might be permanent, it might be unitary, it might be independent of the aggregates or whatnot. So that's how this experience of the notion of I being present all across seems to point to such a possibility. So broadly speaking, when we speak of the notion of selfhood across the philosophy, broadly speaking, we can divide that into two. One that is pointing to self to be inherent, independent, etc. And within that possibility of self being independent, then one explores all those other possibilities of either attributing it to be permanent or totally unchanging, unitary, etc., or being something findable within the objectively findable within the aggregation and whatnot. Whereas there is this other class or school of philosophy which posits that although person does exist, it doesn't need to be, or it is untenable for it to be independent, inherent, whatnot. And that's a position that is accepted by the Buddhists alone. All other philosophical, should we say, spiritual traditions tend to be compatible with the notion that a person is permanent, that the person is not necessarily permanent, but inherently existent. So this position of how things may be, how things may be existing, functional, operational, yet at the same time doesn't necessarily have to be inherent or intrinsically objectively existing, but rather be a product of subjective projection or subjective designation. Within that, we will see how, we can come up with distinct positions, one that of the Chittamatras, where such a possibility of subjective designation is stretched to the point that all there is in reality is just the mind, and everything else is a mere projection of it to the extent of even seeing them to be in the nature of consciousness in the ultimate, with no external world as such. So to a certain extent, this seems to point to a certain extent to what the quantum physics seems to be pointing to, in that the subjective aspect, the subjective agent, seems to have much more bearing on how things are, how things exist, what not. Whereas the other side of proposing a subjective nature of things seems to, at the same time, accommodate the fact that things do not necessarily have to be completely in the nature of mind. Doesn't necessarily have to stretch it to the point to deny externality, external world per se, but rather everything could be posited, but posited on the basis of things having no intrinsic nature of its own. So based on this fact that there is no intrinsic aspect of things, that it could be posited subjectively, but not to the point of completely denying any external reality. So the mere conventionality of things can be very comfortably accommodated on this position that the things do exist, yet exist dependently. I usually tell this to my friends, and I want to share it today also. The notion, the principle of quantum physics, the perspective of the quantum physics, the position of the quantum physics, the scientists who accept such a position, not merely for the sake of holding such a position, but rather through the exploration, if they are convinced of such a possibility, such a reality, in that things are very much contingent on the subjective aspects, then I say to my friends that maybe it is possible that such scientists who are really convinced of this quantum physics position, there is a possibility that they may experience less strong afflictions. That's what I wonder. Might be a difference among different scientists. To find clearly how this may relate to the afflicted emotions or destructive emotions within the person, it may take some time, but that's what I alert people to be mindful of, to pay some attention. Although in the case of the scientists, the very pursuit of the scientists scientific understanding, scientific position of quantum physics has not begun with this intention to find a way to deal with the afflictions. Yet at the same time, when they land, but when they land on such an understanding, and there too has arrived at a conviction, then I feel that maybe at such a stage that could have a remarkable bearing on the afflictions, and that could contribute to undermining or mitigating the afflictions based on what we think that afflictions, afflicted emotions, destructive emotions are indispensably dependent on such a wrong notion of objectivity as the very lifeline of them. So that's what I wanted to share.
We'll have an opportunity, I think, for some additional conversation and questions and answers, so to speak, among our faculty here after Jay Garfield's presentation. I'm not going to introduce Jay Garfield any more than to say that he's very well known to many of us and to you as well. You know, he started out as a professor of philosophy and cognitive science, ranging very far, even into linguistic development in children. But then, relatively late in his career, as things go, he discovered Buddhist philosophy, and Jay Garfield, being a very determined person, then managed to become a great master of Buddhist philosophy as well, and is now also a leading figure in Buddhist studies in the West. And so Jay's task now is to talk about Buddhist philosophy, but also to try to connect it to Western philosophy and to our larger topic. So thank you, Jay.
Your Holiness, it's always a great honor and pleasure to talk philosophy with you, and I thank you for the opportunity. I think this time we will find ourselves largely in agreement. But I want to thank you for the opportunity, especially in this very august place in front of this very learned audience. For me, it's especially intimidating because I'm speaking in front of my teacher, I'm hoping that I don't embarrass Geshe-la by anything I say. And then I see that my former boss, Samdong Rinpoche, has arrived. And so now I have to be afraid that I will embarrass him as well. But yes. So the pressure is here. But I also thank you, Your Holiness, for the very illuminating talk that you just gave, which helps me a great deal. My hope is that what I will do is to build on some of the contributions that have been made here by my colleagues and to show how they come together. In fact, I will probably use very little of the presentation that I've prepared because so much has happened that has made it unnecessary. Geshe-la has given a beautiful presentation of the Buddhist systems. There is no reason to review that. You have given a beautiful presentation of some of the implications for science and ethics. I will touch on those. But what I really want to focus on is the relationship between the self, I'm going to use very carefully language, self to mean the inherently existent self, the gakcha, the thing that we are trying to eliminate. And I will use person or gangzak for the conventionally existent self, so I don't have to keep distinguishing conventionally or ultimately. When I use self or dak, I mean inherently existing self. I think that makes the language easier and more precise. So I want to explore the relationship between the self and the conventional person and the nature of the illusion of self, its origins, and its consequences. And I want to do that primarily from a Western perspective, but connecting directly to Buddhist perspective, because I think that will be interesting for us. So I'm not going to do all of this, but I'm going to begin by talking about two kinds of identity, because I think that when we talk about the self, it's easy to forget that the gakcha, the object of negation, is actually double. It's not only the permanent self in time, but also the self as it exists at a moment. Then I will talk about the illusion. Then I will talk about some Western positions. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about how this will be connected to the presentations that have gone before. Kathy Kerr yesterday talked us through very important issues about how our emotions can modulate our perception. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of the emotions in the perception of self. John talked about the primal illusion of thinking that we're perceiving when in fact we're inferring, and confusing perception with inference. And I'm going to talk about how that plays into the illusion of self. Lara yesterday took us through beautifully, I think, a discussion of what imputation really means, of what it is to say that things like color or being a pot is merely nominal. And I think that when we examine her explanation of the impact of language upon conceptuality, it helps us to understand the difference between positing a self that's independent of that imputation and how imputation gives us a conventionally existent person. So I'm going to hope to tie all of those together, as well as the themes that Geshe La advanced, and in particular his discussion of Prasangika Madhyamaka, to give a sense of how the illusion of self functions. So that's my plan, to end by talking about what it is to be a selfless person, and then to talk about the relationship between self, no self, and morality. So that's my hope. So I wish to begin by talking about two kinds of identity. And I think that it's important to keep them in mind and to notice the difference between asking about whether something is identical over time versus whether something has an intrinsic identity at a moment, because both of those are important components of the concept of a reified self. So when we talk about diachronic identity or identity over time, we're actually taking a thing that is really a continuum to be a single thing that persists with its own identity through moments. We can reject that view, but still fall prey to the notion of intrinsic identity by thinking that even though something may not retain its identity from moment to moment, that at a single moment it has an intrinsic identity. And both of those are connected with the idea of self. Both of those, I believe, need to be eliminated. So what is wrong with diachronic identity? Why is it wrong to say that something can retain its identity from moment to moment? And here I don't even worry about this life and past life or this life and future life. The problem can be posed within a single life, and so is available even to somebody who does not accept past and future lives. It is, in Your Holiness language, a purely secular problem, not a specifically religious problem. Because for a thing to retain its identity, if we mean by identity what we really literally mean by that, to say that two things are identical if they share all of their properties, in the same way, for instance, that the monk Tenzin Gyatso and His Holiness the Dalai Lama are identical, not just a lot like each other, but identical. Or when we say that Jay Garfield and the person speaking now are identical, not just similar, but identical, it's because those things share all of their properties. So if we ask the question, am I now the same person who began talking, then we have to say no. I'm 10 minutes older than he was. He's a young guy. I'm an old guy. That 10-minute difference means that we are different beings, even though we are very similar. So when we look at a continuum, we're looking at a continuum of similar entities, not identical entities. But synchronic identity, the identity at a moment, is just as problematic. Because to have a synchronic identity is to have an independent identity. For there to be some special characteristic that makes a thing the very thing that it is. But that would be for a thing to exist independent of its parts, independent of its properties, independent of its causes, independent of its effects, and none of that makes any sense at all for anything. So even synchronic identity, the idea that there is some intrinsic property that makes something what it is at a moment, is incoherent. When we focus on the self, each of those contributes to the illusion. Each of those is part of the object of negation. So now I want to talk a little bit about that illusion of a self. And what I want to say is that despite the fact that to posit a self, or a duck in that very strong sense, would be to posit something that is continuous over time and has intrinsic identity, even those of us who are good philosophers, even those of us like me who are bad philosophers, intrinsically, innately, instinctively posit such a thing. We have this instinct to take ourselves as identical. So I think of myself as identical to the person who started this talk, even though I know I'm not. I think of myself as having an intrinsic identity.
Solnit was saying that we need to be very careful not to confuse when we talk about identity at a conventional level. Mm-hmm. You know, I did this, I am this and that, which is really a premise upon which communications take place.
Of course.
But then when we talk about whether or not self exists, we're actually talking about a metaphysical, mm-hmm. you know, construct.
That's right.
And so, and for example, yesterday when we were talking about Dhammakirtian, you know, Apoha theory, there was a passage which says that unique individuals, you know, how are unique in time and space, mm-hmm. but they also retain properties and so
exactly.
on. And that idea of intrinsically real, unique, particular is a problem from the point of view of Madhyamaka Prasangika.
Right.
So if we mix all of these up, yeah, and it's also being negated, mm-hmm. Refuted in by Prasangika.
Precisely. So.
Yaba chen mato mato this seva chen mato.
It looks like even if you look historically, you know, some Nalanda masters seem to have been conflating many of these senses and then getting confused. So we also need to make sure that we don't fall into that trap.
Perhaps I think the purpose of our meeting is something make clear and more people understanding. Mm-hmm. Not for more confusion.
Precisely. I agree completely, Your Holiness, and that is one reason I'm trying to use the language very carefully, to use duck when I'm talking about the intrinsically identified person, use gangzak when I'm talking about the conventional identity.
So Solange was saying that in that case, you will have to write a new treatise using that new vocabulary.
Perhaps, but I would point out that Dawa Thakpa actually draws that distinction in very much that way. So I'm actually trying to follow Dawa Takpa very closely here. And since Geshe La has taken us to the Prasangika Madhyamaka view, I'm going to be doing most of this from the Prasangika Madhyamaka perspective. One of the things that your questions Your Holiness raises, though, is a very deep one. Because often when I talk this way, friends or colleagues say, I never think of myself as existing intrinsically. I just think of myself as conventionally existent. But there is a good experiment you could ask people to do to show them how deep that illusion of self is. Here is the experiment. This probably does not afflict you, Your Holiness, but for most ordinary beings, it works.
The next experiment, Jorza. So describe the experiment.
So suppose that you are watching a great sport event like the Olympic Games, and you see somebody win the 100-meter run in 10 seconds, then you might say to yourself, I wish I could have his body just for 10 seconds so I could experience what it's like to run that fast. When you say that, you're not saying, I wish I could be that person, because then I wouldn't know what it was like myself. You're saying, I wish I, Jay, could have his body to run that fast. When I do that, I really tell myself, I think of myself as the possessor of my body, not in any sense identical with my aggregates. Secondly, though, I could do the same thing with my mind. I might say, Geshe Yeshe Thapkyo La gave such a brilliant talk. I wish I could have his mind just for a short while to understand things as well as he does. I'm not saying I wish I were Geshe Yeshe Thapkyo La. I'm saying I wish I, Jay, could have his mind. And when I think that way, I am conscious that I have to think of myself as different from my aggregates, possessing them, independent of them, and that is the dak that is the object of negation. That's the illusion. The illusion is that there is such a self, and that's the illusion that I want to inquire into. And I want to begin now by talking about some positions that are current in the West that I believe fall prey to that illusion and contrast those with the position of Chandrakirti to show how we can get past that illusion. So one position in the West, let's talk about four positions very quickly. One is the position that we would call substantialism, that the self is a substance and its attributes are its properties. Then we think that it continues and that it has some kind of intrinsic identity that makes it the thing that it is. In the West, that position, for instance, is associated with the philosopher René Descartes. That position matches very closely the pre-Buddhist Atman position in India. A second position that has become popular more recently is the position often called pearls on a string, where we give up the idea that there's a continuing self, but we think that there is a succession of momentary selves. A third view that has been popular is the view that the self is not an objective phenomenon, but a purely subjective phenomenon, like the eye is with respect to the visual field, something that sees but is not seen. That is a position very similar to the Vedanta position in Indian philosophy. And then there is a position that the self emerges out of a pattern of activities. Each of these positions, however, is importantly problematic, and the way in which they're problematic will connect directly to things that Lara told us about yesterday. So the position of substantialism, I think, is a very instinctive position, that I'm a substance and that I have various properties and that I continue. If that were true, I would both have synchronic and diachronic identity conditions. And so when I say things like, I was once young, or right now I am both perceiving and acting, that agent and perceiver are the same, that would make all of those things true. But unfortunately for this position, we know, and Geshe Yeshe Tatge Allah showed us why that position is wrong. We don't retain our identities over time. And that good philosophy can show this position to be false very quickly. People have often responded to this problem by retreating from that position and saying, okay, no diachronic identity. Surely I change over time. But at each moment, I must be a self. Because at each moment, the perceiver, the agent, the seer, the hearer have to be the same being. That I experience a unity in my subjectivity. Now, of course, that experience is one that we have to ask about. Is it veridical or is it illusory? And we know that there can be illusions of perception. And as John said, sometimes we think we're perceiving when we're really not. And we have to suspect this. Because when we examine what it is to be a person, even at a moment, good cognitive science tells us how complex we are, how much our cognitive processes interact, how we cannot see any unity in that multiplicity. Our identity at any moment depends on what comes next as we anticipate it, depends on what comes before as we remember, depends upon countless cognitive processes. And so even that kind of intrinsic identity in the end has to be rejected. So some philosophers say, okay, I don't have any identity as an object over time. I don't have any identity. So the third position to which people retreat when this position is refuted is they say, okay, maybe I'm not an object that is identical over time, maybe not an object that even has an identity at a moment. I'm a subject, a pure subject. I'm not in the world of things. I am that which sees the world of things. But of course, that is a very desperate move, because now, having taken myself out of the realm of objects, I'm no longer a cause or an effect. I cannot understand how my cognitive processes pertain to me. And it also makes it very mysterious how I could ever know about myself, since I can never be an object. And so it is a desperate move that might save the notion of self in some respects, but that's not the self we grasp when we grasp the self. We grasp a self that we could know, a self that can be a cause and an effect. So this is a retreat that abandons the entire field. Finally, seeing that these three positions are each untenable, many contemporary Western philosophers have talked instead about an emergent self. This would be a self that is not an independent entity, but comes into being dependent upon the complete assembly, the complete collection of all of our cognitive and physical processes. We might compare that to a storm that comes into existence in dependence on many droplets of water, many moments of wind, and so forth, but which we could call one single storm. On this view, just as storms are very real, just as their water droplets and wind are, we might say that the self is a real thing that can have...
So this is getting closer to the dependent.
Getting very close now. Now we're working our way towards Chandrakirti. Your Holiness, I think of all of philosophy as an attempt to finally reach Chandrakirti's position. And so I think, but this is just my view. So on this view, a lot gets right. That is, we start understanding the self as a constantly changing thing. We understand it as existing dependently. But now note that if we want to also say that it's a real self, a dak, a substantially existent thing, as opposed to simply a designation, simply a conceptual designation, then we've failed slightly. And we have failed in exactly the way that the Vatsaputrian position fails. That is, we have tried to say it's both dependent and yet is a substantial self that has some kind of identity. And it's holding those things together that becomes problematic. In a sense, when we move this way...
So, from a quantum physics point of view, given their theory of the material reality is so close to this idea of, you know, not finding anything objectively real.
That's right.
When you search for it.
That's right.
But how would they relate to something like self?
I think that within a quantum framework, it is impossible to talk about self. But I would agree with you, Your Holiness, that quantum physics is a wonderful way to undermine the notion of self. But, earlier you said that you hoped that quantum physics physicists actually realize no self through this. But I must say, at least for the quantum physicists I know, that they have a conceptual understanding of no self, but they are susceptible of saying, I wish I had his body for 10 seconds. I wish I had his mind for 1 hour, just as you and I are. So it's one thing to rationally analyze and undermine the notion of self. It's another thing to extirpate that innate sense of self that seems to survive all theory, no matter what we do.
I think it's important to know that, for example, there is a sense of self, I am. And what we are analyzing is, in what sense does it exist? What is the status of that existence?
Yes.
So there is a reference to the term I. I do this, I do that. So there is a sense of self. So we shouldn't confuse what is being rejected is the conventional reality of a subject.
Precisely.
Which is a person. So, for example, without the person, we cannot even, from the Buddhist point of view, talk about selflessness of person.
Precisely. And that's where I plan to conclude. But what I do want to say, Your Holiness, is that I think we have to analyze two things. One is the mode of existence of the self or the person, the ngeluk. The second is the nature of the illusion and the nature of the cognitive state that apprehends it, and to ask whether when I apprehend myself, when I say I, am I taking myself to refer to a conventional person, or am I taking myself to refer to a substantial self? That, I think, is the important distinction. So this connects very directly to a point that Lara made yesterday when we looked at that whole picture of many different kinds of pots. And we saw that if you ask what makes them all a pot, It is not anything they have in common, but it's the application of a term. And it's that notion that I think gives us a very nice analysis of what it is to say that things are takvatsam, to say that things are mingtsam, senikidupatsam, that things are merely conventionally established, merely nominal, merely designated. To be a pot is not something that we can discover in those pots. We discover it by looking at our conventions. And when we look at this emergent notion of a self, the proponents of that say we can look just at the psychophysical processes and find the self. We don't need to worry about the designation. And that is the little bit of space between this position and Chandrakirti's position that I think makes it more primitive.
So the basic impulse even behind Madhyamaka school like Svatrantika, who although acknowledge the role mind plays in constructing, but at the same time still insist on some degree of objective reality on the part of the thing itself.
Correct. And I think that that emergent position is very much like a Svatantrika position. The very final position current in the West that I would want to mention would be the position that there is a narrative self. This is one that Richie and I spoke about earlier. It is the most minimal sense of self that you find in the Western tradition. And it's the notion that what we do is we tell on our lives a story and that we are the central characters in the story, so that I spend my life narrating my own autobiography. That's a very nice analysis maybe of what we adults do. But it falls down when you try to understand how very small children who have no language and no narrative understand themselves. So while it has a kind of plausibility, I think we can argue against it as a model of a core sense of self. So now I've talked about some Western positions. I am going to skip almost the entire Buddhist section because Geshe La has done that for me, but I only want to finish with a few remarks about Chandrakirti before I go on to talk about selfless persons and morality. So I am going to go through this very quickly there. When we get to Chandrakirti's position in Umala Jukpa, I think it is important to see that it is fundamentally different from any of the positions regarding self we just discussed. Even though, like the narrative position, it takes the self to be merely constructed, and like the emergent position, it takes it to depend upon the aggregates, it is nonetheless distinct because, on Chandrakirti's view, the takpa, the imputation, is central. That it's not just that the self depends on the aggregates, but it depends upon our conventions for using language, our concepts, the way we think about ourselves and the way we interact. So it is a construction in all of that sense. That's what makes it a conventional person as opposed to a self. It doesn't just depend upon our psychophysical processes, but it depends on social processes. It depends on linguistic processes, as Lara really demonstrated yesterday. And that, I think, is the real difference between these positions. If we don't pay attention to language and convention, we can't understand the difference between a conventionally real person and an autonomous self. A good example of this is the example of money. If we take simply 100 rupee notes or dollar bills, we might think that those things are money intrinsically, that there's something in that paper that makes them valuable. But we know that what makes them valuable is the entire economic system the system of purchasing and selling, the Reserve Bank of India or the Federal Reserve of the United States, and that without mentioning all of those things and our convention for economic transactions, there's nothing that makes those things what they are. Similarly, when we ask what makes me Jay Garfield, what makes you, Your Holiness, the Dalai Lama, we have to talk about an entire range of social conventions to get that identity. That's why paying attention to language and alternative conventions is so very important. So now when we turn to what it could mean for persons to be selfless, we can say this very, very specifically and very, very precisely with this background in hand. We can say that we have many psychological mechanisms, I think innate mechanisms of the kind that Vasu is going to be discussing this afternoon, that cause us to believe in a self, that cause us to take ourselves as selves. And those may have real value. But these psychological mechanisms can generate illusions. You might remember, Your Holiness, when we were together in Kyoto last year, and I showed you all of those optical illusions. Innate visual mechanisms force us to see illusions. Even if we know that they're illusions, we see them. Similarly, I believe innate psychological mechanisms cause us to generate the illusion of a self when what is real is only a conventional person. So it's one thing we have to distinguish between innately coming to believe through fundamental psychological instincts that we are selves, that we have intrinsic identity. And the metaphysical view that there is really a self. Good philosophy, Western or Buddhist, can show us that there's no self of the kind we instinctively posit. But that does not mean, as Geshe La said, and as you said, that there is no person. The conventional person survives that analysis. The task of overcoming illusion is when I say I or na to be referring to that conventional person and not referring to that illusory self. But all of this has ethical implications as well. And these implications, I think, take us directly to things that Catherine talked about yesterday. She pointed out correctly that our emotions modulate our thought and modulate our perception. And in particular, I think that a lesson that we learn from Bodhicharya Avatara, especially the first two chapters, is that afflictive emotions like fear or pride very much affect the way we grasp ourselves. One way to put that is this. An emotion, especially emotions like fear or pride, has a cause and an object, and they're different. The cause of the fear might be the dog growling in front of me, but the object is my thinking I'm going to be bitten. The cause of the fear might be Jhimpala pointing a gun at me, but the object is I might get shot. Or when I experience pride, maybe somebody says something nice about one of my books. The cause may be something that they say. The object is my sense that I'm a great scholar. False, but still my sense. So when we think about experiencing afflictive emotions, they force us to posit that object or self as a cause. And so we can think about one of the ways in which our affective or emotional life modulates our self-perception is that afflictive emotions aren't only the result of self-grasping, they're also a cause of self-grasping. I think that's a very important insight that we find in the first two chapters of Bodhicharya Avatara when Shantideva investigates fear so carefully. Once we posit that self as a result of these afflictive emotions, then that leads to an irrational perspective on the world. That I am here as the center of it, as the subject, and everything else around me is an object. And when I do that, I am the only person who really matters. I construct a world of I and everything else, of self and other, as Geshe La indicated at the end of his talk. And the moment I do that, then it makes sense for me to care about myself, because I'm the only one who matters. I am the center of the universe. And that generates egoism, aversion, and the whole mass of suffering. So when we talk about this notion of being merely posited, we're not talking about the world being unreal. We're not talking about persons being unreal. Rather, what we are doing is recognizing that the world we experience, the world we see, those with whom we interact, are constructed by our psychological processes, constructed for us by our processes, not for that reason non-existent, but they might be constructed and we might be constructed by illusion-generating processes. And the need to see through that illusion is not only a cognitive need, but a moral need, because that's the illusion that is the root of immorality and the root of unhappiness and suffering. And so my view is that understanding that we have no such self, but nonetheless that we are persons, understanding that the world around us isn't distinct from us, but rather is the very matrix in which we live, is the fundamental moral imperative. That is, that it's important for us first to know the illusion of self very carefully, to examine that illusion, to understand precisely what it is. Then to know the cause of that illusion. What is it that gives rise to that? That is the task in part of science and in part of good philosophy. Then to know that if that illusion has causes, that illusion can be eliminated. And finally, to work on the path towards the extirpation of that illusion of self, a path which I think is still very dark and very little understood, but one that I hope good philosophy, Western and Buddhist, coupled with good cognitive science, can help us to illuminate. And that way of understanding illusion can bring us from delusion to happiness. Thank you very much, Your Holiness. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jay. We actually have almost a half an hour in order for us to have some conversation, maybe some questions. Before we do that, I wonder, Your Holiness, if you might like to comment on anything that you heard in Jay's talk that raised some questions or thoughts for you.
The concept of, or the view of selflessness has been very elaborately explained by the Buddha, more particularly in the Prajnaparamita, the Wisdom Gone Beyond Sutras cycles. And likewise, the Buddha has also implied to this view, this notion, in other sutras which we may primarily associate with lower tenets schools such as Citramatra, etc. The general insight is taught by Buddha himself in many of the sutras.
That did you get the translation? Do I have to? Okay. The point His Holiness was making was that in Jay's presentation and in Skishila's, there was a lot of explanation about the way in which historically Buddhist thinkers have thought about the nature of self. And if you look at the various Buddhist positions, all of them have some basis in the Buddha's own words, in a general sense, in a broad sense. But when it comes to the more specifics and details, a lot of these details and specifics seem to have been developed as a result of deep reflection by subsequent Nalanda masters. Not just reflection, but critical reflection, as well as relating what they have discovered into their own personal practice. And through this combination of personal practice and deep insight, these ideas have emerged. So we see, in a sense, kind of a parallel in the Western thought as well, where there is this, as a result of deep thinking, new insights emerge. So which is wonderful.
I think both cases, I think in order to use the individual sort of deep sort of thinking, you need something openness, something fixed, then difficult. So I think the scientist or philosopher, say, you utilize some kind of open thinking, then use our sort of intelligence, deeper, 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 deeper. So it is really wonderful. So I really admire my longtime friend. Although I know some extent your here insight, your knowledge, and of course outside, bold, that easily understand, easily see. Now your presentation really, now I've got now deeper understanding. What's this person? What's this philosopher? Okay, very good.
Thank you so much, Your Holiness.
So His Holiness was. What was impressive was the way in which you were able to correlate the various moves that we see in the Buddhist philosophical traditions vis-à-vis the nature of self, identity of self, with the... Yeah, and particularly, you know, moving towards the Madhyamaka perspective and the way in which you have kind of, you know, joined them or at least drawn parallels to the moves we see in the Western philosophical thinking as well, which is really helpful because otherwise, generally, the Buddhist scholars tend to stay within the framework of Buddhist own classical thinking. Mm-hmm.
I do think that is an important enterprise for all of us. Western philosophers are often guilty of ignoring Buddhist philosophy and indeed all other Asian systems, and that's a terrible thing. But it's also true, of course, that Buddhist philosophers are often guilty of ignoring Western philosophy just as bad.
Kunjungnya kanang pada Debres, kaya sana nukjol cha cha bene Debres tu julian nukjol tatu mau sama apa jigi, nang juga ke tatu tu pasha ne, cita ne sya juga ke tatu sama dia, tuan jigi omar was, di sana ne mongcel leh mutus, ne sunang ode ya bene nang pada tatu mau desa ka cha cha bene, cik ngema agi, nang berang agi, shung dah dah jaga agi shung, zaitun cesha omar tu, nukjol tu tu tuan kura jigi omar dia ya, notu rejas.
Well, one of the tasks of the Mind and Life Institute is to enable this kind of conversation between Western philosophy and Buddhist philosophy, Western science and Buddhist science, because clearly from the conversation, both sides can grow and can find new questions to ask. And with these some 15 or so minutes that we have, maybe 20, I want to see perhaps if there are some questions that have emerged among our faculty members this morning. Yes, Vasu. Vasu Reddy, Your Holiness, is going to be presenting this afternoon on some developmental perspectives on self. Do we have? Yes, thank you.
This isn't exactly about development, but it comes from your discussion about quantum physics and how quantum physics cannot allow a notion of self at all. What would be the position of quantum physics, or indeed of Buddhist philosophy, on the existence, the permanence, the identity of anything? Because it seems to me that quantum physics is saying this isn't; it cannot be a solid, real, bounded, unchanging thing. Then nothing is. So, yeah. Does that make a difference? Not other persons, not the world.
Do you want to understand the theme?
Let me wait for translation.
Yes. Short answer is.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good. That's all
the
problem.
It's the same. To follow, it applies. Yeah.
To comment on that, yes, because the yes is very small. It's a central tenet in Buddhist philosophy of all schools that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. And that really means everything. And that impermanence includes both the gross impermanence, that after a long time everything comes to an end, but also a subtle impermanence, that everything is changing from moment to moment. So that means when we talk about continuing objects, even tables, we recognize that the illusion that they're continuing and permanent is just that. It's an illusion. They're constantly changing. And we're always confusing continua with substantial things. And that was part of the lesson of John's talk yesterday. Now, conventionally, we can ascribe a designated identity, using language, using conceptuality, to join the stages of a permanent thing together under a concept and make it useful. So, for instance, it's no good to talk about billions of tables succeeding each other one after the other if what we want to do is to leave something on the table for a while. But when we talk about a single enduring table, it's important to remember that our talk is conventional and the underlying reality is impermanent. Similarly, it's very useful to talk about me who have lived for too many years, as an old person who's existed for many years, conventionally. But when we do that, we have to remember that the underlying reality is a continuum of constantly changing phenomena. There's nothing wrong with conventions as long as we remember that they're conventions. The difficulties come when we posit a reality that's deeper than that. And one of the insights of Buddhist psychology, from my point of view, is that we are basically wired for that illusion in the same way that we're wired for the Mueller-Lyer illusion. And the work of Buddhist contemplation is to undo that illusion, because that illusion lies at the root of ego grasping, egoism, attraction, aversion, and the mass of suffering. That's how I see it.
I have one sequel to that, sure. Which is that...
Maybe this distinction needs to be made.
When thought gets involved, we construct reality, attribute properties, and then start emotional reactions based on this, is to make a distinction between a degree of distortion that we bring in. So we can see that within the emotions. For example, when the emotions which are more afflictive, such as greed, anger, and so on, arising of these emotions requires much higher level of distortion, attribution of certain properties to the object. Whereas if you look at other emotions which are more constructive, like love, kindness, compassion, and so on, although there is a construction, but the distortion isn't that, you know, so that kind of distinction needs to be drawn.
And then furthermore, you see, on the seed of sort of natural, sort of what is the biological factor, affection, love, biological factor, is it there? This is some sort of relations with this fundamental ignorance. But then, that day as a seed, then use awareness, reasons, the affection, how wonderful, the anger is how bad. So analyze now these long-term sort of the pros and cons. Then through training, used on basis of reasoning, wisdom, the affection, compassion, can further develop. That part not based on biology. Ignorance.
Sorry.
That is the big differences. So this understanding is also the weapon to oppose this destructive emotion, not constructive emotion. For constructive emotion, this understanding actually
strengthens.
I'm going to turn us, if I can, I'm going to move us into it.
But these are the justice of Buddhist sort of to Buddhist. You know, one time one my sort of Christian friend, because Father Wayne,
brother
now John, no longer.
Brother Wayne Tista.
Wonderful Christian practitioner. Wonderful. We often discuss about, you see, practice of tolerance or forgiveness, these things. These are common practice.
Yes.
Then we also, you see, discuss how to develop single-pointed mind. This also, you see, can... I think ancient Christian tradition, you see, such things are there. Then one day he asked me about shunyata. Then I told him,
emptiness.
This is not your business. This is Buddhist business.
Emptiness.
Maybe. But
Your Holiness, I'm going to turn us to Richie Davidson, who had a question. And we actually have two other faculty members. We'll see if we can get through them all. But we're going to have time for more conversation this afternoon, too. So, Richie, please.
Neuroscientists make a distinction between two kinds of fundamental knowledge, declarative knowledge and procedural knowledge. Declarative knowledge is knowing about things, and procedural knowledge is embodied knowledge. It's skill learning is procedural knowledge. Your Holiness, you brought up the issue of whether quantum physicists, based on their understanding, may have a decrease in afflictive emotions. I don't know any evidence, and to be honest, Your Holiness, I'm skeptical. I don't know any data to suggest that quantum physicists are any more emotionally balanced than any other academic discipline, and most academic disciplines are not so balanced in the first place.
I think, you see, your skepticism is actually not yet sort of start to investigation. So your word is too early.
but the question is this. So with regard to this distinction between procedural and declarative knowledge, the analysis...
procedural knowledge labdugala kandate kangratanshayata procedural knowledge the chick the theta the call us ko yudu chene shen jor ba telia declarative knowledge the de yudu chene lo yudu chene shen rich da ta su su combat the de to ne shen rich sik chen ni cha.
So the kind of philosophical analysis that Jay led us through is a wonderful example of declarative knowledge. A deep analysis of the roots of the confusion. The question is, will that kind of declarative knowledge lead to an actual reduction of suffering? Or will it require something in addition? The Buddhist philosophers engage in reasoning, it's also reasoning that is coupled with contemplation. And so I just wonder, Your Holiness, if you can comment on the kind of optimal integrative wisdom that may be necessary to really cut through the illusion to achieve real insight, because it seems from everything we know so far, at least from a scientific perspective, declarative knowledge won't be enough. It'll provide understanding, but it won't provide real transformation.
Declarative knowledge, the youth chain and shame, Ganda di Chipo Gita, you were a couple mentors, consider that the Kurang Shape and Hashing, Tatukutan Namjashi Tugola, Nezumboji, Gotsuvas, in a Gotsuva de Genche, Kansa Kuralia, Kanda Chatan Yomota, Zulu, you were there, the Lola, you were there,
First level is hearing or reading. Then that awareness, you see, further sort of analyzed by yourself, not depend on books or other sort of lecture or
description.
You yourself. And for that, you need, now for example, different philosophical views within Buddhism and also non-Buddhist different school of thought. Very useful. Understand this. Then make comparison. You yourself analyze. Then gradually you see another level of awareness.
Understanding.
Now that is now basis to bring conviction. That's why
It's because of this importance that even in the Buddhist masters' writings, such as Bhava Viveka, there's an extensive explanation of the non-Buddhist philosophical ideas as well.
So that, still that level may not transform your emotion. Then, with that conviction, familiarize. So in order to make, because of familiarization, more deeper way, single-pointed mind now connected. And then, this is some other method side practice Lare. Also now involved.
Lare. Complemented.
So these are Buddhist business.
So it's only says, make, you know, he's agreeing with you that simply knowing isn't enough.
I think, Your Holiness, with all due respect, I think it's everyone's business, not just Buddhist business, because we're really interested in transformation. And we look to you and to your tradition for insights for how to produce more enduring change in a way that would be applicable to this, to 7 billion people.
I think the method side, such as affection, tolerance, forgiveness, these are common all major world tradition. Only difference is the philosophical field. So I believe the all major religious tradition have more or less same potential to bring inner peace and create peaceful family, peaceful world. Provided, I think, including Buddhist, once we accept sort of one's own religion, we should be very sincere and very serious, that religion remain lip service. Then sometimes causing more problem.
I think, thank you, Your Holiness. We have time for one more question, I think. And I believe that that's Carol who's in the queue there, if you would. Can we get Carol a mic? And looks like Lara may have to go in the afternoon, but
go ahead,
Carol.
Hello?
Yeah, it's on.
So I have a question for both of you, because you very nicely deconstructed the self and said that there is no innate ground for self. You then turned around and said we have an innate grasping of self. That is a weird position, which then also doesn't take into account the role of context. So one of the things I'd like to ask both of you is, your perception of the role of context. If a baby was born into a world of mothers and others who do not believe in a self, do you think they would come to grasp and believe in self?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I've been instructed to go first. I think that there is nothing weird or intention about demonstrating that there is no self, but nonetheless an instinct for self-grasping. Again, compare optical illusions. There's no inequality between the two lines of the Mueller-Lyer illusion, but there is an innate tendency to grasp a difference. So we can be innately predisposed to certain illusions, and there are a host of illusions. I mean, one could mention. So there's nothing in tension between no self but a persistent illusion of self.
Now,
if I think indeed many mothers in their interaction with babies are totally selfless. There's a sense in which the parental experience is one of the deepest experiences of selflessness you can have, at least until adolescence hits. But nonetheless, there may be very good reasons, biological reasons, evolutionary reasons, for the arising of an innate grasping of self. It may be something that has enormous survival value for infants. We have to ask what the origin is. In the Buddhist world, we talk about karmic predispositions from beginningless time as the source of that illusion. The way that some of us...
Not only Buddhist.
Right.
Ancient Indian sort of tradition,
precisely.
Who believed previous life. Right?
Precisely.
Yes,
precisely. One way we can naturalize that and bring that in harmony with science and a Western thought is to say what predispositions from beginningless time means is our genetic or biological inheritance as organisms. So if you think of karma in terms of your genetic inheritance, your biological and your cultural inheritance as well, not just biological but cultural as well, then you can think that there is survival value in that inheritance or it wouldn't be there. So there are reasons for self-grasping, even if it's illusory. There are reasons that we succumb to every illusion to which we succumb. Some of those are accidental, some of those may be deep.
Yep. All right, Your Holiness, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for a very stimulating conversation. We look forward to seeing you all back here after lunch at 1 p.m. Thanks for your attention, and see you soon.